The ultimate reality, or what Paul Tillich calls the ultimate ground of being, you're talking nonsense. Because you can't say something specific about everything. You see, supposing you wanted to say God has a shape. But if God is all that there is, then God doesn't have any outside, so he can't have a shape. You have to have an outside and space outside it to have a shape. So that's why the Hebrews, too, are against people making images of God. But nonetheless, Jews and Christians persistently make images of God, not necessarily in pictures and statues, but they make images in their minds. And those are much more insidious images. Buddhism is not saying that the self, capital S, the great Atman, or whatnot, it isn't denying that the experience which corresponds to these words is realizable. What it is saying is that if you make conceptions and doctrines about these things, you're liable to become attached to them. You're liable to start believing instead of knowing. So they say in Zen Buddhism, the doctrine of Buddhism is a finger pointing at the moon. Do not mistake the finger for the moon. Also, we might say in the West, the idea of God is a finger pointing at God. But what most people do is, instead of following the finger, they suck it for comfort. And so Buddha chopped off the finger. And undermined all metaphysical beliefs. There are many, many dialogues in the Pali scriptures where people try to corner the Buddha into a metaphysical position. Is the world eternal? The Buddha says nothing. Is the world not eternal? And he answers nothing. Is the world both eternal and not eternal? And he don't say nothing. Is the world neither eternal nor not eternal? And still he don't say nothing. He maintains what is called the noble silence. Sometimes later called the thunderous silence. Because this silence, this metaphysical silence, is not a void. It is very powerful. The silence is the open window through which you can see. Not concept. Not ideas, not beliefs, but the very goods. But if you say what it is that you see, you erect an image and an idol and you misdirect people. It's better to destroy people's beliefs than to give them beliefs. I know it hurts, but it is the way. That is what cracks the eggshell and lets out the chick. Of course, if you want to stay in the eggshell, you can, but you'll get addled. This, then, you see, is why Buddhism is in dialogue form. The truth cannot be told. It can be suggested, it can be indicated. And a method of interchange between teacher and student can be arranged whereby the teacher constantly pricks the student's bubbles. And that's what it's all about. And because that's the way it is, we find that in the course of history, Buddhism keeps changing. It develops, it grows. As people make all these explorations that the original Buddha suggested, they find out all kinds of new things. They explore the mind. They find out all the tricks of the mind. They find out ever so many things. And they begin to teach these things, talk about them. And some people, in modern Asia, influenced by Protestantism, say, let's go back to the simple original teachings of the Buddha. These like people say, let's get back to the simple teachings of Jesus. Well, the simple teachings of Jesus are as lost can get. Nobody can read the New Testament with a clean mind today. Because whenever you look at the Bible, don't you hear some preacher's voice in your childhood reading those words? Hasn't your culture taught you to interpret these words in certain ways? You can't get back. And nobody can get back to Buddha. You can only go on to Buddha. So that's why in Zen they just burn the books up. I mean, occasionally. Because to burn up books, you've got to have some books to burn up. But when, you guys say that the teaching of the founder is the thing. This is terrible. It's like the oak suddenly saying one day, hey, we oughtn't have all these leaves around here. We ought to be just that simple little acorn. Now, a living tradition grows. But what it does is this. As it grows, say it grew from a seed, an acorn, keeps dropping off new acorns. You don't go back to the old acorn, you get a new one. And that becomes a new seed for another tree. This is fine. Now, let me just warn you. The scholarly study of Buddhism is a magnum opus beyond belief. There are two collections of Buddhist canonical scriptures. One is in Pali. The other was originally in Sanskrit, but we don't have a complete collection of it in Sanskrit. We have these collections in Tibetan and Chinese. Bigger than the Encyclopedia Britannica, as a matter of fact. So it's a formidable enterprise to get into the Buddhist scriptures, and what's more, most of them are unbelievably boring. They were written by monks with plenty of time to pass on wet afternoons during the monsoon. And they repeat and they elaborate and they are full of kind of preparatory. You know how in the silly trick in radio they have of giving a fanfare to introduce the program. So in the same way, these scriptures have fanfares in which all sorts of Buddhas are introduced and we beings, and they're all described and where they were assembled and how many of them there were and where they were sitting and what kind of bows they made and all this jazz. And then finally a few pearls of wisdom are dropped by the Buddha. Or else they sometimes go on for pages and pages of actually very, very subtle and very profound discourse that is not dull if you have a penchant for that kind of thing. But I warn you, don't try too hard to read the Buddhist scriptures. It's all right to read the Dhammapada, which are sayings of the Buddha. It's all right to read the Diamond Sutra. It's all right even to read the Surangama Sutra or the Lankavatara. But when you get mixed up with the larger Prajnaparamita and all those things, you're in deep water. So you see, from time to time, Buddhists get tired of the scriptures. Actually, they keep them in a revolving bookcase in some monasteries. Think about so high, so wide, it revolves. And instead of reading all this stuff, you're supposed to be able to acquire as much merit as you would from reading it all by twirling the bookcase around once. In Zen monasteries, they have an annual ceremony for reading the scriptures, but they are printed like an accordion. In other words, the pages are connected to each other zigzag. And then they have board on the back and the front, so that you can pick one up and go whirr, like that, you know, like a slinky moves. And so they each monk is assigned a pile of the volumes. This happens once a year. And they all chant sections of the scripture, but very often each monk chants a different one. And while they're doing this, they pick up a volume and go, whirr, click, and put it down on the other side. Pick up the next one, whirr, click. And this is the annual reading of the scriptures. There's a wonderful picture of this being done in Suzuki's book, The Training of the Zen Buddhist Monk. So you see, Buddhists are funny about scriptures. They don't treat them the way Christians treat the Bible. They respect them. They occasionally read them. But they feel that the writing, the written word, is purely incidental. It is not the point. And indeed, it can be a very serious obstacle. Zhuangzi, a Taoist sage, once said, just as a dog is not considered a good dog just for being a good barker, a man is not considered a good man just for being a good talker. So we have to watch out for the traps of words.
Out of Your Mind now continues with the next lecture from the World as Emptiness lecture series.
You must understand, as one of the fundamental points of Buddhism, the idea of the world as being in flux. I gave you the Sanskrit word anitya as one of the characteristics of being, emphasized by the Buddha, along with anatman, the unreality of a permanent self, and dukkha, the sense of frustration. Dukkha really arises from a person's failure to accept the other two characteristics, lack of permanent self and change. You see, in Buddhism, the feeling that we have of an enduring organism, I meet you today and I see you, and then tomorrow I meet you again and you look pretty much as you looked yesterday, and so I consider that you're the same person, but you aren't. Not really. When I watch a whirlpool in a stream, here's the stream flowing along, and there's always a whirlpool, like the one at Niagara. But that whirlpool never really holds any water. The water is all the time rushing through it. In the same way, a university, the University of California. What is it? The students change at least every 4 years. The faculty changes at a somewhat slower rate. The building changes. They knock them down and put up new ones. The administration changes. So what is the University of California? It's a pattern, a doing of a particular kind. And so in just precisely that way, every one of us is a whirlpool in the tide of existence. And we are in every cell in our body, every molecule, every atom is in constant flux, and nothing can be pinned down. You know, you can put bands on pigeons or migrating birds and identify them and follow them and find out where they go. But you can't tag atoms, much less electrons. They have a curious way of appearing and disappearing. And one of the great puzzles is, in physics, what are electrons doing when we're not looking at them? Because our observation of them has to modify their behavior. We can't see an electron without putting it in an experimental situation where our examination of it in some way changes it. What we would like to know is what it's doing when we're not looking at it. Does the light in the refrigerator really go off when we close the door. But this is fundamental, you see, to Buddhistic philosophy. The philosophy of change. From one point of view, change is just too bad. Everything flows away. And there's a kind of sadness in that, a kind of nostalgia, and there may be even a rage. Go not gently into that good night, but rage, rage at the dying of the light. But there's something curious. There can be a very fundamental change in one's attitude to the question of the world as fading. On the one hand, resentment, and on the other, delight. If you resist change, of course you must to some extent. When you meet another person, you don't want to be thoroughly rejected, but you love to feel a little resistance. Don't you? You know, you have a beautiful girl and you touch her. You don't want her to go blah. But so round, so firm, so fully packed. A little bit of resistance, you see, is great. So there must always be resistance in change. Otherwise, there couldn't be even change. There'd just be a the world would go, and that'd be the end of it. But because there's always some resistance to change, there is a wonderful manifestation of form. There is a dance of life. But the human mind, as distinct from most animal minds, is terribly aware of time. And so we think a great deal about the future, and we know that every visible form is going to disappear and be replaced by so-called others. Are these others others, or are they the same forms returning? Of course, that's a great puzzle. Are next year's leaves that come from a tree going to be the same as this year's leaves? What do you mean by the same? They'll be the same shape. They'll have the same botanical characteristics. But you'll be able to pick up a shriveled leaf from last autumn and say, look at the difference. This is last year's leaf. This is this year's leaf. And in that sense, they're not the same. What happens when any great musician plays a certain piece of music? He plays it today, and then he plays it again tomorrow. Is it the same piece of music, or is it another? In the Pali language, they say, na cha so, na cha anno, which means not the same, and yet not another. So, in this way, the Buddhist is able to speak of reincarnation of beings without having to believe in some kind of soul entity that is reincarnated, some kind of Atman, some kind of fixed self, ego principle, soul principle that moves from one life to another. And this is as true in our lives as they go on now from moment to moment, as it would be true of our lives as they appear and reappear again over millions of years. It doesn't make the slightest difference, except that there are long intervals and short intervals. high vibrations and low vibrations. When you hear a high sound, high note in the musical scale, you can't see any holes in it. It's going too fast. And it sounds completely continuous.